All right, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today for the May edition of the Ag Sector Council seminar series, which focuses on the issue of mycotoxins and their potentially devastating impacts on agriculture, nutrition, and international development outcomes. The Ag Sector Council monthly series is a product of the USA Bureau for Food Security and is implemented by the Feed the Future Knowledge-Driven Agricultural Development Project, lovingly known as KDAD. I'm personally very excited for this topic. Food safety and nutrition are very interesting topics to me, and aflatoxin has always been just a completely fascinating topic, and we're expanding a bit on aflatoxin to encompass all of the mycotoxins here, so we're hoping to have a really great discussion. And so I'm delighted to see so many people in the room. We're trying out a new kind of seating arrangement for Ag Sector Council as well, which I think will help with networking, and so feel free to let me know any comments you have about the seminar series, any suggestions for the future, any questions about knowledge management at the USA Bureau for Food Security. I'm happy to help. And I should introduce myself. My name is Julie McCarty, and I'm a knowledge management specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. So my quick housekeeping issues are always just please silence your cell phone so that we don't interrupt the speakers. Also, we are recording this event, and so you'll receive an email after the fact letting you know when the recording is available. Because we're recording and because we have a large webinar audience joining us today, we always ask that during the Q&A period, which we will hold till after the presentations, just that you wait for us to pass you this handheld mic so that the webinar audience can hear your questions as well. So with that, I will introduce our introducer, our leader, who is Ahmed Kablan, an international nutrition and public health advisor with the USA Bureau for Food Security, working in the Office of Agricultural Research and Policy. And his work at USAID focuses on the agriculture nutrition nexus and food safety, and he manages the post-harvest loss, soybean, and nutrition innovation labs for Feed the Future. And he's going to give a brief introduction and introduce our speakers. So, Ahmed?
Thank you, Julie. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning for the Ag Sector Council, and thanks for KDAT for the logistics support and for their support in providing the venue and the technical support. This topic of mycotoxins and the common, well-known, biggest bad guy of them, aflatoxin, it is an important topic for both agriculture practitioner and the public health community. Examples of what aflatoxin or why we care about mycotoxins. It is, as you know, they are fungus product or proteins, toxin that are produced by asparagus fungus that attack grains. Other the causes or the damages, the insect damage, drought, high temperature, or other stressful factor in the environment or in the agriculture, in the field. We need to control them, mycotoxin spread, all the way from the field to the table, and the contamination could happen with different kind of mycotoxin at different part of the value chain. Aflatoxin also, they are one of the most potent carcinogen that cause very, really very bad case of liver cancer or hepatocellular carcinoma. Also, aflatoxin, a lot of observational studies in humans have been associated aflatoxin with up to 35% of stunting. A lot of research is still needed in order to prove the evidence to show the causal linkages between stunting and aflatoxin or mycotoxin. But based on animal studies, show that aflatoxin cause a fetal loss, congenital malformation, intrauterine growth retardation, and early infant death in animals, not in humans. An example of the human studies was a cross-sectional study in about 785 pregnant Guinean women at birth. What they found that the women with the highest quintile of the aflatoxin exposure, they were twice as likely to have a low birth weight compared with the women who are at the lowest quintile of the aflatoxin exposure. This is just a taste of what aflatoxin or mycotoxins could cause for human health. We will hear more today about this, the health impact, the impact on agriculture, the impact on development, what kind of technology we might need or we can adapt in order to control aflatoxin, and what are the gaps in research and development that we need to cover. And I'm excited to introduce our speakers, Drs. Felicia Wu, John Leslie, and John Bowman. So when you ask a question, please specify which John you are asking to avoid confusion. Dr. Bowman, he is our senior agriculture advisor at the USAID Bureau of Food Security, and he managed the global food security program. He's the program area lead for safe and nutritious food, and he has over 28 years of experience in international development, worked in over 40 countries in international agriculture research center, multinational food companies, and international consulting firms. And Dr. John Leslie, he is a university distinguished professor and the head of Department of Plant Pathology at KSU. And he has been working since 1984. Dr. Leslie studied genetics of fungi, the genus Fusarium, and a group, which are a group of fungi that are, he will talk about them today. They are also bad for human health, bad for agriculture, and we should not forget about that mycotoxin, they are not aflatoxin only. Dr. Felicia Wu, she is a John A. Hannon Distinguished Professor at the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at the Department of Agriculture, Food and Resources, Economic at Michigan State University. Her research concerns on the global health and economic risk of foodborne and feedborne toxins and the cost effectiveness and feasibility of intervention to improve food safety and resource poor settings. I'm pleased to present Dr. John Bowman, who will give us the overview and the kickstart our webinar today.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming. Also, to those of you online, thanks for participating in this event. It's a very important topic. I've essentially, in the last 5 years I've been here working for Feed the Future, I came in pretty green on this topic, and now I know a lot more, but I think it's just all the experience I've had with various university experts and our development experts out in the missions just makes me shake my head and think about all the more questions that are raised in terms of how to deal with this very elusive yet problematic bioagent. I've been asked to do the overview. I don't have much time, and I'm typically long-winded. And so I thought I'd give you the take-home messages right off the bat, in case I don't get to the end. But these three things, I want to impress upon you that when Feed the Future started up, there was very little work on aflatoxin, anywhere, whether out of Washington funds or mission funds. And I back of the envelope type calculations tell me that conservatively we've tripled or quadrupled our investments in the mycotoxin related areas since around 2010, and it's important for you to realize that. But although this total pool of investments, despite the progress within Feed the Future, the total pool of investments I think is relatively low considering the very potentially high levels of damage to health and productivity which this agent can cause. And then the final point is we have a wide range of investments now from Washington funding and field-based funding, but I'm going to make the proposition that it's possible that our current mix of investments at AID may be off a bit. There may be kind of the balance may be not quite right, and there may be some kind of a need for strategic realignment in order to bring in more funds to the area, because again the high levels of damage to health and productivity are just escalating, and we've done a pretty good job, but we need to bring in more funding to this area. That's crucial. So maybe change the mix of investments so that we can attract more funding to the general sector. I've got two slides here on essentially it's the laundry list of all the things we're doing, the major activities in aflatoxin, mycotoxin related research and development. They've only given me 10 minutes or less, so I can't go through all of these. But I think when you follow up with KDAT at the end of the, there'll be linkage to materials and documents that can give you more details on these projects. But on this first slide, you see some of the major investments we have in Bureau for Food Security and in the Agricultural Research Programs Office, and in our sister office, the Country Strategic Implementation Office, MPI, Markets and Partnering Initiative, and Africa Bureau. Again, I'm not going to go through all of these. I do want to just highlight, first of all, the very kind of exciting work that a nutrition innovation lab led by Tufts University is doing, because they're really getting at the causal relationship between aflatoxin in the diet and in the blood in relationship to health and nutrition outcomes such as birth outcomes, and this is one of the very unique projects that we have in this area, and I'm going to make some comments on it later. It's very important. We have a suite of breeding projects, both conventional and non-conventional. Some in collaboration with the USDA, others in collaboration with the private sector. This is conventional marker-assisted breeding, and this is iRNA breeding. I also want to highlight the really good work that are in our sister office in terms of the capacity building work at the trade hubs and the support to the Partnership for Aflatoxin and Control for Africa. Support to the Secretariat. This is coming. A lot of support coming out of our CSI office at these trade hubs to look at regulatory and harmonization type issues. In addition to basic best practices, they're very concerned here in terms of raising awareness at ministerial level. I'm going to move to the next slide. These are the field funded projects. We have. All of the regional missions have been very interested in aflatoxin and working on various project interventions because of the trade hub presence. And this is an issue which essentially is very instrumental in stopping essentially the robustness of trade of grains in the region because of standards that are not harmonized. So the Africa Regional Mission has a Disappear project, which is I think it's ending now, but it's been extremely instrumental in working on these regional issues. And then we have a suite of projects that are focused on biological control of the fungus to the use of atoxigenic strains. You'll hear more about that from the technical experts later, but pretty robust funding out of Zambia, Mozambique, Rwanda, and then Tanzania several years ago put out a very, very impressive, you know, prevalence study on the prevalence of aflatoxin, mycotoxin in the marketplace. So again, my back of the envelope estimates is that in 2014 we're at around 20 million per year, and when we first started in Feed the Future, maybe only 2 to 5 million per year. And I can assure you that in 2015, this number's going to jump quite a bit. What are mycotoxins? Well, Ahmed quickly went over that. I think he mentioned all of this. The important thing to realize, if you're not too familiar with the field, is that aflatoxins are not fungi. They are metabolites, or you can almost call them poisons produced by fungi. Highly carcinogenic, acutely toxic at times, but also, actually what worries me more is this insidious low, these chronic levels of aflatoxin in the maize-consuming beneficiaries that we work with in many of the Feed the Future countries, maize and groundnuts. I was asked to say, why does USAID care about mycotoxins? Well, when I start to think about this, when you look at that very high level of value chain investment that we have in Feed the Future from the get-go in maize and groundnuts, I think this is one of the primary reasons. If we didn't have so much work coming out of our missions, value chain type work and associated work in maize and groundnuts, we probably wouldn't be doing much at all in aflatoxin, quite frankly. So just highlighting here, you know, maize value chain is extremely important. Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Ethiopia, Zambia, DRC, East Africa Regional Mission, Ghana, Senegal, West Africa, Nepal, Haiti, Guatemala, and Honduras. Groundnut extremely important in Malawi, Zambia, Mozambique. So even if you knock out the interest that the regional missions have in maize, you're talking about two commodities that are in approximately, you know, of high level importance in 70% of our Feed the Future missions. And this is a big problem in maize and groundnut that just can't be avoided. Another aspect is over the last 5 years, I think Feed the Future has gone down the road of more attention and more funding in the area of post-harvest loss. It was year one and year two of Feed the Future, there was virtually nothing. Now there's quite a bit of interest and investment, and essentially this whole mycotoxin problem is a post-harvest loss problem. So you get loss of productivity, loss of quality, and the loss of the ability to trade robustly in grains across the regions. And finally, you have these basic human health impacts, which I think the technical experts will go into more detail: stunting, immune system suppression, carcinogenic effects, and acute toxicity and death. So essentially, this is an agricultural problem that's causing severe, you know, human health problems. What's kind of interesting about that statement is, you know, I really think it's one of the this is the foundational or seminal rationale behind Feed the Future, a new kind of agriculture that essentially is has in order to make proper agricultural proper impact. In Feed the Future, our agricultural interventions have to have a very positive impact on health and nutrition parameters. And this is exactly what research in the area of mycotoxins is accomplishing. It's foundational. And I really don't think much of anything represents this interface between agriculture and nutrition better than the aflatoxin issue. If you eliminate or mitigate aflatoxins, you know, highly in the ag value chain, you will have a significant positive outcomes in nutrition and health. And this is essentially the perfect type of subject matter that Feed the Future was conceptually designed to work on. So some quick conclusions about aflatoxin. Aflatoxin-free staple foods would be an agricultural result with huge nutritional outcomes. So why are the funding levels so relatively low for such a pervasive and important problem? In a nutshell, my thinking on this, the global health community is not convinced that it's a priority equal to that of maternal and child health, diarrheal diseases, pulmonary diseases, malaria, HIV. They don't feel that it's really a primary killer, so they sideline it. But it is an accelerator, but I think global health community wants a more robust and convincing evidence base that it's an equal opportunity killer. And we don't have that base just yet. Another important conclusion that I think in order to come up with game-changing solutions in this area, the solutions have to be regional, both from research point of view and host country ownership point of view, and any type of cooperation we have between USAID and USDA on this issue should be regional. So we have the Partnership for Aflatoxin Control in Africa that was launched at AGOA. We have this really robust investment of the USAID East Africa Regional Mission. We have very strong research collaboration with USDA, which I can't go into detail on, and we have a strong commitment from the Gates Foundation. So all of these are steps in the right direction. Those suite of projects that I showed you essentially offer interventions in these basic areas: detection, pre-harvest, post-harvest, storage, processing, regulatory and harmonization interventions. But the one thing that's really lacking is this evidence base and causality. I mentioned that our nutrition laboratory led by Tufts is working very aggressively in this area, and more needs to be done. So I just want to close I want to put on the table kind of a pressing need that we have. And that is, I think we need a lot more joint programming between agriculture and health community on aflatoxin impact in this rubric of the first 1,000 days. We need co-designed operational research between agricultural and health. It has to be co-designed from the beginning. So we have the role of, what are some things that could be worked on, and role of aflaprone complementary foods such as maize, groundnut sauce, cassava, sweet potatoes, cow's milk, the attributional role of aflatoxin in stunting cognitive development, impairment of the immune system. This is really the key area. What's the attribution of aflatoxin in these problems? Because other things will affect these problems, like parasite load, pesticide, other toxins in the environment. But what specifically is the attributional role of aflatoxin, and if we can quantify it as being of extreme significance, we can therefore maybe convince the health community to put more dollars in. So this premise for a discussion that I want to have is, we should maybe think about, and this isn't my mantra or anything, I'm just putting it on the table for a discussion point, that we should probably fund much more work on the evidence base and less on agricultural best practices, such as the breeding, the storage structures, the biological control. And so the proposition is that if we do that kind of work, more donor and ministerial funding that is health sensitive will roll in at much higher levels of magnitude. And then if that does happen, we can ultimately be, those investments can ultimately be reapplied to these agricultural best practice interventions, which we're already doing, but at a low level. So more funding on the evidence base will reel in more money that can be applied to ag interventions that can be more robustly applied. So this is a question of balance. We may have a poor balance in what we're doing right now. Not enough on these ag health linkages, which we need to build the evidence base. And so possibly we should think about changing that balance. So that's just something you may agree or disagree with, and I hope it comes up in the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And now we'll have Dr. Wu to talk a little bit about the fungus and the health impact.
Thank you, Dr. Kablan and Dr. Bowman. It's a pleasure to have the chance to come here and talk with you about aflatoxin, which is my main area of research and an area that's just fascinating if you should try to think about a new area to go into. What Dr. Bowman had mentioned about the link between agriculture and health is absolutely true in the case of aflatoxin in our food supply. This is an agricultural problem that has severe human health impacts, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and East and Southeast Asia. So rather than go over again some of the points that Dr. Bowman had already brought up about the fungi that produce it, what I want to emphasize again in this slide are the human health effects. Liver cancer is the one that we first knew about 50 years ago being associated with aflatoxin. In both humans and in animals, a variety of animal species, we saw that aflatoxin was a very potent liver carcinogen. In fact, it's the most potent naturally known human liver carcinogen. It synergizes with the chronic hepatitis B virus infection. So if you're an individual who is positive for hepatitis B and you consume a lot of peanut butter or maize that looks like that, then your risk of developing liver cancer is considerably higher than if you had just one exposure or neither. Aflatoxin has been implicated in stunting in children, and I'll show you the evidence base for that in another slide, with acute toxicosis at high doses, and also modulation of the immune system. And this is where we get into the role of aflatoxin in infectious disease as well. So how much do each of these effects matter in a global context? Well, first, let's think about the effect of aflatoxin on development outcomes. And why is it that we ought to focus on this quote-unquote accelerator as opposed to possibly a primary cause? Because aflatoxin is associated with all of these adverse growth impairment measurements in children, stunting, underweight, and wasting. We know that it also causes growth impairment in animals. We have over 50 years of research in that area. Aside from the fact that it's causing the animals to suffer, it also leads to less efficient animal protein production, which is very important from an economic standpoint in resource-poor regions. And furthermore, we have pretty good evidence that aflatoxin can adversely affect immune system function. Now, this could lead to worse or more adverse outcomes from infectious diseases, whether respiratory diseases or diarrheal diseases, which are major killers in low-income nations. So for all of these reasons, because of the contributory role of aflatoxin, this is an important problem to study. Let's look at the issue of stunting in children. This is defined by the World Health Organization, or WHO, as a condition in which a child is 2 standard deviations or more below a particular WHO growth reference. So if you're 48 months old, you have to be this tall, and if you're 2 standard deviations below that or more, then you're considered stunted. Now, it's not so much an adverse thing just to be short in and of itself. Rather, stunting that's caused by environmental or dietary conditions is associated with increased vulnerability to infectious diseases, as well as cognitive impairment that lasts well beyond the first 5 years of life. A recent study showed that there's close to 200 million stunted children around the world under the age of 5, and as you can see in the dark regions in that map, sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast and South Asia are the parts of the world that have the highest prevalence of stunting. Not too surprisingly, perhaps, there's also a lot of aflatoxin exposure in these countries. Now, we had published a study in 2011 that looked at the entire evidence base of aflatoxin and growth impairment in both animals, a variety of animal species, as well as in children. I'm only presenting the data here for the evidence in children. Rather than go through a lot of detail of what's in this table, what I want to point out is that many different things were measured to try to understand aflatoxin exposure. Aflatoxin in food was actually measured. Biomarkers of aflatoxin in maternal blood, cord blood, and child blood, and even maternal breast milk. And in every case, the more aflatoxin there was, the more stunting, underweight, and wasting there was in the children who were exposed to aflatoxin. Now, how can we begin to get around the problem of what can we do about the aflatoxin problem? Well, one of the things that we have to remember is because we are dealing quite often with resource-poor settings, we need to consider the cost-effectiveness of different public health and agricultural interventions to reduce the aflatoxin problem. The World Health Organization first came up with this metric of how it is that we can measure cost-effectiveness in terms of health savings, because they were applying this to whether or not to iodize salt around the world. They basically said, well, if in a particular population, the intervention to reduce aflatoxin or to reduce a particular adverse health effect, if it costs less than the gross domestic product per capita on average in that population, multiplied by the number of disability-adjusted life years that are saved, then it's a very cost-effective intervention. And this is something that we're looking at right now. Previously, so this is a list of potential interventions to which we could examine the cost effectiveness. It turns out that there are a number of different interventions that can help to reduce mycotoxin levels in the food supply or help to ameliorate them in the body if you have already consumed the mycotoxins. There are pre-harvest interventions such as simple good agricultural practices, genetically enhancing plants' resistance not just to fungal infection but also to drought and heat, which predisposes plants to fungal infection, and biocontrol methods. There are post-harvest methods such as improved sorting of the obviously contaminated foods, drying and food storage. And then if you have a plate in front of you and you already know that there's aflatoxin in the food, what can you do at that point? There are actual dietary interventions as well. One thing, improving dietary variety, moving away from the maize and the peanuts that have such high levels of aflatoxins, and pterosorbents that can be added to the food, dietary chemoprevention, a natural kind that I'm talking about that can be found in leafy green vegetables, cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower, and also in vegetables in the onions and garlics and leeks family. curcumin, which is found in curry, can also help to inhibit various enzymes that can cause aflatoxin to become more toxic in the human body, and the polyphenols that are found in green tea. Finally, vaccinating individuals against hepatitis B helps to counteract that synergistic effect of hepatitis and aflatoxin in causing severe liver damage. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail, but if you want to ask questions about them later, we've looked at the cost effectiveness of different types of aflatoxin control methods. And I can see that time's running out. We've published recently on the link between increasing dietary diversity and lower aflatoxin-related liver cancer risks in one part of the world, Qidong, China. This was a part of the world that had a lot of liver cancer originally, and when the population switched from consuming primarily maize to consuming primarily rice and leafy green vegetables, then liver cancer incidence just over the last two decades has decreased by 45%. And that is from switching to a dietary staple that had a lot of aflatoxin to almost no aflatoxin. And this is a slide of Dr. Leslie's that shows that, in fact, if we were to try to reproduce this effect in Africa, might we turn to sorghum and millet instead of maize, because aflatoxin levels are considerably lower, not just the means, but particularly the ranges, if you take a look at this slide. What relatively aflatoxin-free crops could become dietary staples in Africa? Well, here's a potential list, and we can talk about that later if you're interested, but I think I'm just about done, so thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wu. And now, Dr. Leslie, just to give us some about aflatoxin or mycotoxin, what they are and their chemistry.
Okay, so I'm sort of the cleanup hitter to collect the other things that are other than aflatoxin. And so the first thing to realize is that in spite of aflatoxin's importance, there are a lot of other mycotoxins. There's estimates of probably thousands of these things actually made, most of which we have no idea at all what they do or if they have any economic impact at all. But here, I've got slides on just a few of them. And so the okra toxins are also made by Aspergillus species, different ones than make the aflatoxins, also made by some Penicillium species. And they've got a very different spectrum of problems because they're primarily known for kidney failure issues. And you can see there that cacao, nuts, grapes, coffee, and wheat. So the interesting thing is you don't see maize on that list. Maize is sort of gets all of these things for the most part, but it doesn't get this particular one. And the okra toxins can be very important. They're regulated. And, you know, at one time, the Europeans had their regulations set such that imagine Europe without chocolate, coffee, and wine. And, you know, and you can see that it could have a severe cultural impact just on them. Zearalenone is another compound that's widely known. This is made by a fusarium, two different species most commonly. It's known mostly as this won't kill you, but what it does is it's a pseudoestrogen that will cause a premature development in women, can cause sterility in men. It's a problem with maize and with wheat. And also, these same fungi make another series of compounds that I didn't put up here called the trichothecines. And trichothecines are very important, especially in wheat, because they are major trade barriers. And they are also kill the yeast that goes into brewing. So if you try to malt something that's contaminated with one of these fungi, often you will not get a successful malt and your beer's no good. And that can be very important not only in the U.S., but in a lot of other places. Finally, in this made by, not by these two, but a related trichothecine, are compounds called T2 toxin. And T2 toxin is perhaps one of the nastiest chemicals made by any living organism. It was the active ingredient in yellow rain in Vietnam in the 70s, and was also used supposedly by the Russians in Afghanistan, so that it becomes it's a select agent in the United States. You can't even have very large amounts of it in a lab to work on it unless you've got it under all kinds of lock and key things. So T2, which can be potentially produced by some of these fungi in some of these countries, has got huge political ramifications that we need to be thinking about, in addition to just the food ramifications, because finding T2 in the food would just cause, you know, all kinds of interesting problems. And then fumonisins are the last of the other toxins that I'll talk about for the moment. Again, this is primarily a maize toxin. It causes the big problem that it causes, what I tend to call brain rot in horses, because you end up with just large holes in the brain of the horse, and that poor horse that you see there would be walking in circles and eventually would simply fall over dead because there's been so much brain damage that's done. In humans, it's associated with esophageal cancer and also associated with neural tube defects in infants. And the interesting thing with the neural tube defects is that those come associated with a genetic defect that's known in humans. Both the fumonisins and the genetic defect block the same enzyme and give you the same phenotype. A point that we need to recognize: we see all kinds of levels of things that are recommended in the literature for exposure. So, for example, with fumonisins, usually for humans, what we see as a level in human foods is 1 or 2 micrograms per gram, as shown on the left there. And this is something from Walling Morassus's group in South Africa. And you can see that most of us would be in the, we can debate whether you're 60 kilos. A lot of you probably are like me and are significantly more. But be that as it may, the issue here is that notice the amount of fumonisin in the diet actually matters. So that if you've got a very high if you're eating a lot of maize, if you're eating 400 or 500 grams a day on the right side of that table, it doesn't matter how low the level is, you're still probably getting a very toxic amount of the toxin showing up. So what's considered safe for us is very different than what's going to be that found in a developing country where the diet is very different. This is a story that has worried me for a number of years, and I call it a trickle-up story. So the traders in developing countries are going to purchase the best grain they can buy from the farmers. Okay, they buy the good-looking stuff because that's what they can sell. Makes perfectly good sense. And what they do then is they leave the farmers with the most heavily contaminated grain. So the farmers can end up with 95% of the toxin left in what they've got, and maybe 5 or 10% going to market. So that gives you the better stuff in the cities, and the best stuff gets sold to people like you and me who eat the least amount of the corn and, of course, are exposed to the least amount of the toxin. So that it's really a trickle-up. Those of us who eat the least and can actually afford, so to speak, the higher exposure actually have the least. So sort of a last slide here. To summarize some of the things that we've been talking about, why do mycotoxins matter for reaching development goals? Well, first, it's a very clear interaction between agriculture and health. You've heard John say this, you've heard Felicia say this, you're going to hear me say this, and it's really, really true. It's one of the most important ties that we've got. But what it means also is that it's an interdisciplinary tie. You don't find any particular group really owning it. So you don't find the plant pathologist like I am owning mycotoxins. You don't find the nutrition people owning them. You don't find the medical people or the vet people. Yeah, we all deal with them. Yeah, they're all important, but they're not on the top of the list. So one of the critical things that AID can do is they can serve to bring these interdisciplinary groups together to get them working to realize what the problems are and how to go about solving them. It affects all kinds of different animals and crops. These are not a problem for us. Why? Because we've got a good food regulatory system. But when you go to that local market in rural Africa and somebody's just brought something in, especially if they've just had it ground and you can't even see if it's green or pink or red or something that it shouldn't be, you know, you can't tell. It's just flour and you're buying it and it's not checked. Subacute and chronic exposure issues are big deals. Okay, it's not just that it kills you, it's that it half kills you. and keeps you from doing what you could and developing your potential. And it has a disproportionate impact on the rural poor. The people that we really care a lot about really get hit the hardest by this. The size and the severity of the problem is not well understood. We can project what it is, but we don't really have a good handle on how bad the exposure is. Some of the toxins, like T2, have got political implications, and the problems in tropical regions often are different from those that we find in temperate regions. And finally, just sort of a little note down there at the bottom. Yeah, you can have trade issues. These are one of the biggest non-tariff trade barriers that exist. And so with that, just to give you some idea of the types of storage problems you actually can have and why you might have issues with things sort of misbehaving, there are some examples that I've actually seen from South Africa and from West Africa. And with that, I'll give it back to you, Ahmed.